Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, maybe we should call it an investment rather than a fine. Goldman Sachs settled its housing bubble fraud case with the U.S. government yesterday, as you've probably heard, for a $550 million fine. And while that sounds like a big number, Goldman's stock value went up by $800 million yesterday on the news. Not a bad day's work if you can get it. The New York Times reports today on what appears to be a lack of remorse for Wall Street's excesses on the part of many, many banks. For example, Jamie Dimon, head of J.P. Morgan Chase, promising that consumers, not his company, will pay for the new bank reform bill. He compares it to a merger. On the other hand, what's good for the banks is good for New York's tax revenues and public services, at least in the short run, and good for Wall Street-related jobs. Let's talk bank reform and the effects on New York. With the Goldman Sachs case settled and the Dodd-Frank bill now officially passed by Congress, with me are Catherine Wild, President and CEO of the business group The Partnership for New York City, and Greg David, Director of the Business and Economics Program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism and former editor of Crain's New York Business. Hi, Catherine. Hi, Greg.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Catherine, who blinked on this $550 million settlement, Goldman or the Obama administration?
Well, I think it's a resolution that means we're going forward. It's just like the enactment of the financial regulatory reform. For those of us in New York, we're glad it's behind us, and hopefully we can move from everybody figuring out how to blame Wall Street for the financial crisis to working with Wall Street to fix it. So I think in both cases, the Goldman Sachs settlement and the enactment of financial reform, it's good news for New York.
Greg, same question. Who blinked?
Oh, the government blinked. This is a huge win for Goldman. $550 million is insignificant in terms of their profits and revenues. No changes at the executive level, no penalties for individuals, no trial that might expose what they did. There's an analyst, Brad Hintz, who said at the beginning when Goldman stock declined that this was a buying opportunity, and boy, he has been proven right.
And the company admitted mistakes but not wrongdoing in the charge of defrauding investors by betting.
Brian, here's,
yeah,
to me, the
implication
the most fundamental
of what Greg is saying I object to, because I think that what's clear from everyone I've spoken to in the industry is that Goldman was being snared for what was accepted industry practice and retrospective, and this is a retrospective judgment. So I think the settlement of this case is a symbolic gesture to sort of move on, put this behind us, but to draw, as you know, there was no admission of guilt as part of the settlement, and I think that was appropriate.
Greg, you were going to say?
I was going to say that, you know, what's most amazing to me about the settlement is that the fine's $300 million, and there's $250 million to compensate investors for losses. $250 million? I mean, the losses on this instrument were huge. So the government obviously decided at some point it didn't have a good case.
What were some of the things, Greg, that you think might have come out at trial that we will now never learn?
Well, you know, there's a split view of Goldman on Wall Street. There are many people on Wall Street, and I talk to them all the time, who think Goldman is the evil empire. And I think that that attitude, you can find that in a lot of places. You know, we had this great testimony from the CEO of Washington Mutual when his CFO wanted to use Goldman. He said, God, using Goldman, it's so dangerous. There are a lot of people who think that, and that might have come out at trial.
Catherine,
and we know what happened to Washington Mutual.
Meaning?
Well, no, meaning I don't know how much his CEO knew about how sophisticated he was about the ways of Wall Street. It might have been his naivete operating out there from Seattle.
Well, Catherine, if you said this was going on industry-wide, creating this kind of instrument and then betting against it while selling it to investors, does the new law passed by Congress protect investors from this kind of thing in the future, or is your position that it was always okay and it still should be okay?
It's unclear what the new law passed by Congress does because it involves more than 500 rulemakings that will actually define the details. It cuts a broad stroke. I think one important thing it does is it creates, it acknowledges that the shadow banking system, the unregulated banking system, was the source of a lot of these problems. Much of the focus has been on banks, which are regulated institutions, as opposed to on the larger systemic risk. So what this does is it does set up a new regulatory structure, a council, that will be paying attention to the major risks across the system, across industries, not just going in and auditing bank by bank, but looking at the entire system and looking at everybody who's a player with big financial stakes. So I think that's going to be very important and very useful. It also strengthens, from New York's standpoint, strengthens the role of the New York Fed and of the Federal Reserve Bank generally, and hopefully that is going to be a plus for reinforcing New York's, the strength of New York's position in the financial regulatory system.
Greg, your take on that New York angle?
Well, I agree completely. There were provisions that were talked about that would have damaged the New York Fed, and there were provisions that would have been much more problematic for Wall Street. There are, I think, there's so many things one could say about this bill, right? It's incredibly complicated. Thousands of pages of regulations have to be made. But I think we could say a couple things. First of all, it's going to make Wall Street somewhat less profitable. Not only the bill, but the other steps, because the firms are going to have to put up more capital. I mean, that's just a fact of life. It won't make them unprofitable, but it will make them less profitable. The bill and everything else that has happened also mean that bonuses are going to be a little bit less than they used to and paid primarily in stock. That's going to mean there's going to be less money immediately to spend when the bonuses are paid out, but not necessarily less money long term. Third, and one of the most overlooked parts of this bill, is that this bill has made the consumer banking business much less attractive. And that is not good news for J.P. Morgan Chase or Bank of America or similar institutions. Overdrafts, have once a great source of revenue, are now, frankly, not any source of revenue. The way they used to price their credit cards has now been completely changed. And the new consumer finance agency in the Fed is going to issue rules that will make consumer finance less profitable.
But who's going to pay for that in the long run? You mentioned the overdraft. In the New York Times today, there's an article that certainly could get up a whole new head of steam of public outrage against the banks. Headline, "Done Fighting, Banks Are Already Working Around the New Law of the Land." It says in part, "Banks are already moving to make up the revenue they will lose on lower overdraft and debit card transaction charges by raising fees on other services. Banks like Wells Fargo, Regions Financial of Alabama, and Fifth Third of Ohio, for instance, recently began charging new customers a monthly maintenance fee of $2 to $15 a month, as much as $180 a year, on the most basic accounts." It goes on to say, "Bank of America rolled out a fee-free bare-bones account on Wednesday, the eve of the Senate vote. The catch? To avoid any charges, customers must forego using tellers at their local branch, use only Bank of America cash machines, and opt to receive only online statements." And then it quotes the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, saying, "If you're a restaurant and you can't charge for the soda, you're going to charge more for the burger. We've been gearing up for this like a merger." So it sounds like no remorse, for one thing, no accepting of financial responsibility for whatever helped to get the economy into its current mess, and they're ready to take their bonuses and pass it all on to the little guy.
Well, Brian,
well,
on
this
that
is what Jake,
front,
go ahead, Kathy.
Catherine, go ahead.
Now, on that front, I think that what happened during the financial regulatory bill debate is everything in the kitchen sink got thrown in, and what started out to be an effort to avoid another crisis and to avoid having taxpayers bail out banks again in this country ended up being everyone sort of threw in their pet project, and Senator Durbin threw in the cap on behalf of basically Walmart and Target and the big merchant stores that didn't want to continue to pay the bank's fees on debit cards, they got a cap on that into this regulation. It had nothing to do with the financial crisis. And I think what the banks were both annoyed by that, because it was an inappropriate use of this reform vehicle to get something in there on behalf of the superstores to save them money. And what the banks are pointing out, and I think Diamond's comment goes to, is this doesn't relieve anybody. This just pushes down more costs on consumers. And so I think Greg's comment originally was right, that there is going to be lots of collateral damage, and one of those areas is to consumers and what they're going to have to pay, because people got through and various interests used this bill to get through their own agenda items. You're going to end up having consumers pay more.
Greg?
I'm not so sure. Look, what Jamie Dimon said yesterday is what he hopes happens, because he does have to make his consumer business profitable, and that's his, not only his right, that's his obligation. But look, there's a lot of competition. Long term, what the banks did is they got most of their money from consumers with weak credit, who did overdrafts, who used their credit cards differently, and the benefits went to consumers. I'm one of them, who never carries a balance on his credit card, hasn't paid a fee on his checking account for 5 years. There's still a lot of competition out there, though. And we'll see whether Jamie Dimon and Wells Fargo will actually be able to force me to pay fees on my my checking account, and to make me pay more money for my credit card. I'm not so sure they're going to be so successful.
I think what you're missing is one of the most expensive components of this bill, after they knocked out the bank tax, was the cap on the interchange fees that are charged to merchants by the banks. And that's a huge loss and a huge cost to banks that are retail banks. And that was the point I was trying to make.
Catherine, were you suggesting, though, that what is being labeled a consumer financial protection bureau and things like that was really not on behalf of the consumer, but was a special favor for Target?
This isn't the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This is a different provision in the bill which caps the fees that banks charge to merchants for the services of debit cards. Those are not paid by consumers. They are paid by the stores, just like the stores pay on credit cards when somebody uses it.
Unless we say that the stores pass them along to consumers, just like banks will pass along these other things.
Well, that is unclear how that works. The argument is, from the bank side, that this is going to go right to the bottom line of the merchant's profits.
Greg, anything on that?
That's exactly right, and that's why we don't know. We don't know whether Walmart will pass it along or not, just the way we don't know what the banks are going to do. You know, I think we said we don't know a whole bunch of times here this morning, and that's one of the most important things. This is an incredibly complex bill, which basically mandates that all these federal regulators go out and issue regulations to implement it. So we don't know exactly how a lot of this stuff is going to work. We don't know how onerous it's going to be, and we don't know how costly it's going to be. And despite, 2 years of legislating and pontificating and maneuvering and lobbying, it isn't exactly clear who the winners and losers are going to be.
We're talking about the new bank reform bill and the Goldman Sachs settlement, primarily their effects on New York, with Greg David, former editor of Crain's New York Business, now director of the Business and Economics Program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, and Catherine Wild, president and CEO of the business group The Partnership for New York City. And Ed in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Boy, that was quick. Hi. I wanted to comment several things about the Goldman thing. First of all, $550 million is a lot of money for anybody. I don't consider that a slap on the wrist at all.
Their stock went up $800 million yesterday.
Okay, but that was not due to anything that Goldman did. That was the market. That was the decision that lots and lots of people made in terms of buying Goldman stock.
That was the market reacting to the $550 million fine,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, the fact that it's over. Because the fact is that Goldman Sachs is very good at what they do. They work harder than anybody else. They wouldn't hire me, even though I'm very smart. And, you know, sometimes people actually make a lot of money because they deserve it. They dedicate their lives to making money. That's all they do, 24/7.
And is that a, well, you know, a lot of our listeners are hearing that and thinking, well, that in and of itself does not make somebody deserving.
It doesn't, but it doesn't make them undeserving either.
Thank you for your call. Tom in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes, hi. All of this sounds like a good time to split up these big banks and to increase competition, and then the fees won't be raised. We don't have enough competition in our banking system. That's my that's the issue, I think.
Thank you very much. Steve in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. What I don't understand is, with small business always being pointed to as the engine that drives the economy, the small businesses are getting choked by the lack of access to credit. And I was just wondering if there's anything in the new bank legislation that induces or forces the banks to put out some of the money that they've been getting from taxpayers.
Catherine, do you think so?
Actually, I would take issue with a couple points there, but the one is that the studies that have come out through the Independent Small Business Federation and a number of other organizations in the last few months on the availability of credit to small business have found that the overwhelming reason that small business is getting choked is because the economy, their business activity, won't support borrowing and loans. It's not that credit's been cut off. And banks are sitting on money, have credit available. They have, the issue is our economy. And hopefully, passing the financial regulatory reform bill will help to begin to create more stability, more certainty in the future of our economy, so we can get credit flowing again to small business as their businesses pick up and they're comfortable borrowing.
Greg, do you agree?
I agree, absolutely. This is one of the great myths that's out there. I was at a conference at Bank of America today, and the head of the New York region began by saying, you know, that we all know their problems with the small business demand. He doesn't have creditworthy customers to make loans to. And then this woman came up to me who runs one of these mini lenders,
uh-huh,
who says she lends to immigrants, but she says, I've got money for mainstream companies, and I can't get them to come in my doors. So I think that's crucial.
Why won't they come in her door?
Because businesses aren't prepared to borrow because they don't think their prospects are good enough. Creditworthy businesses are not prepared to borrow. Remember, Brian, when people say they're not lending to small businesses, well, we don't want the banks making loans that have no chance of being repaid, do we?
We could get calls all day, because we've done a few shows like this, from owners of small businesses who would say, I am credit worthy. I'm ready to invest more in my business. I keep getting turned down for loans.
I'll send you a copy of the survey, Brian, that we got, that I saw yesterday, that just there were three different data points and data surveys that have been done by small business themselves. Yes, there are always people who are unable to borrow. People, you know, a quarter of the small businesses that start every year don't finish the year and go out of business. There are always those complaints, but all the studies, all the surveys show that this is a problem of the economy and of business confidence and having a solid business opportunity. This is not a problem of credit availability.
Steve in East Northport, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I don't know where to start. I'll just start with a couple of things. One, something that's not in this bill is leverage. No one's talking about the reason why the housing bubble collapsed wasn't because of the housing market itself, was because of the leverage that was created. Now, banks lend money based on how much they could then borrow against their assets, and each asset they're allowed to borrow X amount percent of that, whether it be credit card debt, real estate debt, other loans, so on and so forth. And the leverage, how much banks could leverage up their assets, hasn't been addressed. Second thing I'd like to say is these toxic assets that the banks were bailed out on, none of these assets have been booked marked to market. Nobody has priced any of these yet. These assets still exist, on the books of these banks because it's a huge domino effect. If someone prices one, then everybody else has to price accordingly, and no one has yet taken the courage to price it, and the government hasn't taken possession of these assets from these banks. They're still on the books, leveraged the same way they were before the housing bubble.
The toxic assets. Steve, thank you. Greg, on that leverage point, is there anything in the bill that stops banks from over-leveraging, really over-borrowing in the future?
Yes, absolutely. I'm just sorry the listener's not right. The whole bill requires lots more capital to be put up by these firms. Not only here, but there are all kinds of provisions affecting derivatives that'll do that. I think that's one of the big gains in the bill, that there will be less leverage. So that is one of the things the bill has accomplished.
That's absolutely correct. And the bill also looks to the Basel process that's going on now to apply that on an international level so that hopefully, I mean, one of the limitations of the bill is we're only talking about the U.S. The decision, the leverage issue has to be addressed not only domestically but internationally, and that's going on in the conversations at the so-called Basel III talks right now.
In fact, here's President Obama speaking to reporters about the passage of the bill yesterday afternoon.
Wall Street reform will bring greater security to folks on Main Street, to families who are looking to buy their first home or send their kids to college, to taxpayers who shouldn't have to pay for somebody else's mistakes or irresponsibility.
And I think he's talking about stability in terms of more capital requirements so banks don't get so over-leveraged. But on the taxpayers paying for someone else's mistakes or irresponsibility, I guess we could, we'll avoid going back to that question about all the fees that are going to be passed on to consumers in new ways. Catherine, on New York, did New York's lawmakers help to stave off some of what you consider the worst that this could have been?
Absolutely, yes. The New York's lawmakers were engaged in this process. They recognized financial services as our hometown industry, and they worked very hard to be helpful in making sure that we stuck to, that the legislation was as focused as possible on fixing the problems that caused the crisis as opposed to going off the reservation.
A number of
lawmakers were very helpful.
Who did what, for example?
Well, obviously there are two sides to that. In the Senate, Senator Schumer is by far the most knowledgeable, sophisticated, has the biggest history in terms of understanding the financial services industry, and I think that he worked with leadership in the Senate and on the committee to try to make sure that some of the worst proposals, the idea of breaking up the big banks and somehow destroying the anchors of our international financial system, were avoided. The group called the New Democrats that Congressman Joe Crowley of Queens leads did a terrific job providing with Congressman Mike McMahon and Congressman Scott Murphy from upstate of helping to make sure that many of the provisions of the bill went through that were solid in terms of protecting consumers, but avoided, again, punishment of institutions, destruction of institutions, having to divest the institutions of the derivatives business, which is one of the most profitable businesses and important to tax revenues of New York. So I think the New York delegation was terrific on a variety of fronts.
So some people will hear that as New York members of Congress work to weaken bank reform rather than strengthen it.
That would be unfair. The elements of reform they were very tough on, supporting the Consumer Protection Bureau, making sure there was a systemic regulator. What they did was, for example, fight to make sure the New York Fed remained a professional and wasn't a political appointee so as to politicize the office, to make sure that Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas's amendment that would have simply arbitrarily forced banks to spin off their derivatives operations, we would have seen them go overseas and lost that activity to the United States, and most of that activity takes place in New York. They stepped in when they were those efforts that were simply aimed at destructive efforts, at political playing to the interests of constituencies that wanted to just punish Wall Street, but were not looking at the solid principles of reform. I think our delegation was very good in both the Senate and the House of making sure we provided a litmus test. Is this a constructive effort, as Senator Schumer said, or is this a destructive, punitive effort that's just meant to dump on Wall Street?
But, Greg, going back to the president's quote about Wall Street reform bringing greater security to folks on Main Street, a lot of listeners might think, well, if Schumer was in there fighting against the breaking up of the too-big-to-fail banks, then we have too-big-to-fail again, which may help New York in the short run because that's where most of these banks are located, or many of them. And yet we have, therefore, more risk of taxpayer bailouts in the future, more risks of the economy being too dependent on these behemoths.
Well, I think there are two separate issues here, so let me take them separately. One, the New York delegation. One of the most remarkable things about the New York delegation is they don't support New York City interests the way they do, for example, in Michigan. Have you ever heard a Michigan senator or congressman criticize General Motors or Ford or come out against the bailout? I mean, if you were doing this show in Detroit, Brian, I don't think you would ask the question. So, A, I think it's just we expect our representatives to stand up for our most important industry. That they don't do it as much as people in Michigan do is the problem, not the solution. Too big to fail is a much more difficult problem. I'm one of those people who think the bill did not deal with too big to fail. I think the president is fundamentally right that it's fundamentally wrong and that we might bail out someone again. The problem with what the listener says is it's a global marketplace, and it's unclear that we can break up our banks when they're giant banks elsewhere.
Well, maybe we need international regulation of an international banking system, but I guess that's a show for another day. And I hope that journalists everywhere, and I presume that journalists in most places, are asking the questions that counterpose maybe short-term parochial interests against questions of right and wrong. So we will leave that there. Catherine Weil, President and CEO of the business group, The Partnership for New York City. Greg David, Director of the Business and Economics Program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Oh, by the way, Greg, a couple of commenters on our page want to know where you bank that you don't pay fees. Are you willing to say?
Sure, I bank at Chase, but you don't have to pay. You don't pay checking account fees at anywhere, and I don't even have a minimum balance requirement. I know Jamie Dimon's coming after me, but I'm ready to leave if he does.
All right. Well, we'll see what the options are. Greg, Catherine, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Up next, the Cuomo financial juggernaut revealed. Stay with us.